Thank you for your invitation to go to your last morning session. I do my own practices in the morning, things I've committed to my teachers to do, and they're a non-negotiable. So I won't be able to make it, but thank you for the invitation. Also, I was thinking, because that was inviting for next Friday, which is a long time away. And I don't know if anybody else has felt it. Did you feel today was rather unusual, actually keeping silence? Did it put you back in retreat today? Yeah? Because I don't know about you, but I've really found that the amount of talking, which I'm as guilty of as anybody else, has really been affecting my mind and taking me out of retreat. And retreat time is very, very precious. I didn't have as long of a time as you did. And so I really like to stay in retreat until the end. And I have a feeling that by the time, although your minds are revving to go and, you know, you're with Patricio and you're with Jan and you're in Never Never Land and you're, you know, wherever, your body is still here. And once you get back there, then you're going to look on this and it's all going to be like a dream. And you're going to say, oh, the last 3 weeks I spent talking and not, you know, am I letting my mind go all over the place? Okay, so the time to do retreat is short. It's very precious. You may never get another chance like this in your entire life. So, you know, if you can keep your mind in retreat, it's very good. If you can't, at least keep your mouth closed so that other people's minds can be in retreat. Okay, because I don't know about you, but I found, like I said, the amount of talking, which I've been doing too, it very, very distracting. So, you know, I was initially thinking at the beginning of the retreat that a few days before the end we would kind of break silence and start talking, but with what's happened the last couple of weeks, I think it's actually, we've already done that, and so now we have to go back into retreat, and I think it's good if we stay in retreat until the end. Okay? Your mind will be very delicate when you leave retreat. So, you know, that's why I thought, we advised you at the beginning to stay a few days later here. Because even though you may feel like your mind is bouncing all over the place, in actual fact, it's a lot calmer than it was before. And you're a lot more open and receptive than you were before. And as soon as you leave the Abbey, you will feel, without any effort, the barrage of sensory experience coming your way. So, you know, I think it's good to, you know, stay in retreat, take a few days afterwards to stay here and just be with your Dharma family. And, you know, if you're going to talk, at least we'll have a little bit of talking, but I think we'll all get talked out pretty quickly. And, you know, before you hit the city with everything that's going on there. Okay, just some advice from experience, but I know everybody will basically do what they want. But I'll just put it out there in case it, you know, makes a difference. Okay, so I thought that I'd continue with the questions that you had made a list for Rinpoche, unless there's something that you wanted to discuss at the beginning now? Okay. There was one other question that Maria had written, and it was about when Arch went out and caught the mouse and the vole, and she said that all she could see at that time was the mouse, you know, the vole who was suffering so much. And she couldn't see Arch because Arch was like the perpetrator of the harm. And so she said she just kind of saw very vividly how she kind of threw sentient beings out, right? You know, just kind of, you know, you just, this one's doing something bad, so you just kind of throw them out the window. And so, yeah, we do that all the time, don't we? You know, somebody does something we don't like, somebody says something we don't like, they have different political opinions or different religious opinions than we do, and we just give them a label, you know, enemy, perpetrator of harm, somebody who's, you know, jerk, whatever you want to call them, and then we just kind of discard them in the trash bin. They cease to be a sentient being. And so this is very, for our development of bodhicitta, this kind of mind, which comes so spontaneously, as you notice, is completely the opposite of the mind of bodhicitta. Okay? Because the mind of bodhicitta is, feels connected and related to each and every sentient being. Okay? Why? Because they're exactly like us. They all want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. Okay? So on that level, there's nobody who's anybody different than anybody else. So whether they're the perpetrator of harm or the victim of harm, it doesn't matter, because they all want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Okay? So that's one reason why they're equal. A second reason why they're equal is that the perpetrator and the victim often change places. Okay? When you think about karma, when somebody perpetrates harm, in the future life, they become a victim. When we see them in the role of perpetrator, we throw them out the window. When we see them in the role of victim, we have compassion. That's wrong. That's our biased mind. Because somebody isn't in the role of victim by accident. It's because they perpetrated harm. That doesn't mean the victim deserves to be harmed. Certainly not. But what I'm getting at is we can't, you know, having compassion for one end of the deal and not for the other one is really inaccurate, because it's actually the perpetrator of the harm that we should have the greatest compassion for, because they're creating the negative karma which is going to bring them suffering. Okay? So that's another reason not to kind of brand somebody and throw them out the window. A third reason is that all sentient beings have been kind to us in the past and will be kind to us in the future. Yeah, they've all been our mothers. So it doesn't matter whether it's some mosquito who's biting you or your best friend. They've all been your mother in a previous life and taken care of you and given birth to you and everything like that. And so since everybody's given that kind of kindness to us, discriminating, you know, some as closer and more deserving of love and compassion and others as more distant and more deserving of hatred and ostracization, that's a wrong conception. Okay? So, you know, the fact that you see this kind of discrimination coming in your mind is very good, because before we never had it. We just took our opinions and discrimination and bias for granted. Now we're beginning to see how bias and prejudice our mind is. You know, all of us who thought we were politically liberal and tolerant, actually we're extremely prejudiced. Yeah, against anybody who hurts me or disagrees with me or doesn't like me or harms me or the people that I like. Okay? So sometimes it's hard to admit to ourselves exactly how prejudiced and biased and discriminatory we are. But once we do, then we can start contemplating these three different reasons and really work with our mind to neutralize it, you know? And this doesn't mean neutral in the attitude of, well, yeah, okay, I don't care about anybody. You know, they're all equal, so I don't care about any of them. But they're all equal, and since they've all been kind and they all want to be happy and they don't want to suffer, then I care about all of them. I'm open and receptive and have a feeling of connection and care with all of them. Okay? And so we start training our mind in that way. And that's something to be mindful of. Okay? We see, you know, in the house, I was really teasing about all these signs about thank you for your mindfulness. What in the world does that mean? Thank you for your mindfulness. You know, we're giving an order and then we're saying thank you for your mindfulness. I mean, huh? What in the world does that mean? Okay? What we want to be mindful of is this equality between self and others and this equality between all various sentient beings, that there's none who are an inherent friend, an inherent enemy, an inherent stranger. That's what mindfulness means, is we're mindful of that fact. Okay, we train ourselves in it. So whenever we're with sentient beings, instead of letting our judgmental mind chip in and say, oh, this one does this, and that one does that, and how come they walk like this, and how come they wear these clothes, and how come they talk like this, and how come they have that idea, and how come they do this, and they should do it that way, and they should do it this way, and I have the best way for them to do it, why don't they listen to my advice? And, you know, instead of going on and on like this when we see others, to remain mindful of the fact that they've all been our mother and been kind. And they're all doing jobs in society that we benefit from. And that they're all exactly like us, wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. And that also like us, they've all been perpetrators and they've all been victims. And so they're worthy of compassion no matter which end of the deal they're on. Okay? And so that's something to be mindful of. Okay? So let's not just throw around this word mindfulness like, you know, I'm giving you an order and then saying thank you for being mindful. Close the door mindfully. You know, be mindful as you close the door quietly. Isn't that kind of a deceptive Buddhist jargon way of saying close the door nicely and stop slamming it, you idiot? You know, say please close the door softly. You know, if you blow it the first time, go out and come in again. I've been tempted to ask some people to do that sometimes. But the thing to be mindful of is something like this: is the equality among sentient beings, equality between self and others. Another thing to be mindful of is the fact that we're all in cyclic existence. And we're all subject to, you know, birth, aging, sickness, and death. And that that's not a pretty scene, and that the causative of it is our ignorance, anger, and attachment. And if we're mindful of that, then the determination to be free and to attain liberation arises quite easily in our mind. Okay? So that's another way to practice mindfulness. Or another way to practice mindfulness is be mindful that the base of the label and the labeled object are different. Okay? What, you know, the whole thing about our grasping and inherent existence is we mix the base of the label and the labeled object. And we mix them up and we think they're the same thing. So the base is the parts of the thing, the qualities of the thing. The object is what is merely imputed or labeled independent upon that base. But we mix the two up together and that's, you know, and grasp it as true, and that's, you know, what ignorance is. Okay. So if we can begin to differentiate those two things, yeah, when we look at this thing here, yeah, there's blue, there's round, there's hardness, okay? It has the ability to hold water. It has a base. It has a handle. Okay? On top of all of these qualities, or in not on top of, in dependence upon all of these qualities, we give the label cup. But the blue's not the cup, and the round's not the cup, and nor is the handle, nor is the base, nor is the ability to hold water. Okay? So if we look at the base and concentrate on the features of the base, the blue, the color, the shape, the hardness, the parts. You can look at it and say, this is not the cup. Because the base is not the cup. The base is the blue and the round and the bottom and the handle and the ability to hold water. That is not the cup. The cup is what is labeled independence upon all those qualities. So you can look at this thing and say, this is not a cup. Conventionally, it's a cup, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You say, go get me the cup. Everybody knows what we're talking about. This is a cup. So this is a cup, but this is not a cup. Okay? Now, it's not too difficult when you think about the cup. Now, when you start thinking about me, okay, you switch it to me. Okay, so there's color, you know, color of the body, shape of the body, shape of the fingers, shape of the face, shape of this. There's, you know, heads and hands and torso and legs and, you know, there's all those things. Then there's all these emotions and all of these thoughts, right? And independence upon all of that put together, we give the label me. Yeah. So if you focus on the base, all these parts of the body, all these moods and emotions and consciousnesses, you can look at that base and say, that is not me. And then you find one voice inside going, what in the world are you talking about? I'm right here. This is me. Excuse me. I'm right here. That's the object to be negated. Okay, and you'll find that that voice that's saying, excuse me, I'm right here, that's the one our whole life revolves around. Our entire life, everything we do, everything we think, everything we say, everything we want revolves around that feeling of, here I am. This is not just a base of color and shape and hardness and body parts. It's not just a base of eye consciousness, ear consciousness, mental consciousness, different thoughts, different moods. This is me. You know, the most important thing in the world. So there, right there, we have the self-grasping, this is me, and the self-centeredness. I'm the most important one in the world. To the two big enemies. Forget about what anybody else can do to you. These two are the two biggest enemies. The worst any other living being can do to us is kill us. No other living being can send us to the hell realm. No other living being can make us be born as a hungry ghost or an animal. What makes us get born in the lower realms? These two. The self-grasping and the self-cherishing. No matter how much any other sentient being harms you physically, emotionally, no matter how much they criticize you or abuse you or tear you apart, none of them can hurt you as much as these two mental states can. Because like I said, the worst anybody else can do is either hurt our feelings or kill us. You know? And that's one life. You know, we die in one life. Well, we're going to die sometime anyway. fine, it's not a big deal. And we've done it before, it's not anything new. Okay, we've died infinite times before. But, you know, what is it that sends us to the lower realms? Yeah? It's the attachment and jealousy and pride and laziness and everything that grows out of this self-grasping and this self-centeredness and all the karma we create, you know, based on all of those things. You know, that thought that, no, this is not just the base of a label. This is me. I am here. You know? And I want my Cheerios, and somebody who doesn't give me Cheerios is my enemy. Okay? And I want things this way, and somebody who gets in the way of that is my enemy. Yeah? And so, and then, you know, out of that mind, then we harm other living beings, don't we? We create the karma, a negative karma, we get born in the lower realms. Nobody else sends us to the lower realms. No other sentient being sends us to the lower realms. It's our own negative mind that does. Okay? So if we're mindful of this, you know, the harm that that ignorance and self-centeredness do to us, then we're not going to follow them. And when they rise in our mind, then we're going to switch and we're going to be mindful of bodhicitta. We're going to be mindful that the base and the label are different. You know, that there's no inherently existent me there that's to base everything, you know, to center all of existence upon. Okay? So then that's the real meaning of mindfulness. Okay? Getting what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
How many retreats did it take to be mindful of that?
How many retreats does it take to be mindful? It depends on the individual. Because some people have had more familiarity with it in previous lives than others. Yeah? And some people put more effort into a retreat than others. So there's no, it's not, Dharma isn't like going to school where there's a set number of courses and then you graduate. Okay? Actually, this was very disconcerting. There was somebody who came to live at the Abbey and she'd just gotten out of school and she was, you know, when I was at school there was, you know, a program. And, you know, you do this and this and this and this and then you get your degree and you graduate. And I come here and there's no syllabus and there's no graduation. And yeah, right. That's true. It's lifetimes of practice. So it depends on, you know, what we put into the practice and how much familiarity we have with it in previous lives. And we're all very different. Yeah? And that's why you never know who anybody is. Mm-hmm. And that's why they say it's better not to criticize anybody because you don't know who's who and who's had, you know, realizations in the past and is just coming into this life and is going to get them, you know, resume them again and, you know, who's just freshly out of the lower realms. No, we don't know. So better to treat everybody respectfully. Other questions? Okay. I mean, that's just a whole interesting practice to do, you know. You're walking to session and just pose the question to yourself, who's walking to session? Me! I am! Me, the one with the hurting knees. Yeah. With the hurting back, the berserky mind, me! Okay? Who? Who? I am walking to session. We say, I am walking on the basis of the body. It's the body that's walking, isn't it? The body's walking. On the basis of the body walking, we say, I'm walking. Is there any other I besides the one that's been nearly imputed on the base? I'm the one with the berserking mind. You know, we label that in dependence upon some thoughts, some emotions. We label I. Yeah? Apart from those thoughts and emotions, is there any other reason? We're saying I, me with the berserking mind, you know? I is being labeled independence upon those things. It is not those things. Yeah. Our problem is we develop whole identities about this. You know, we start out with this real me, and then, of course, I am union oneness with all these negative thoughts. So I'm hopeless, you know, it's nothing that can be done. I'm inherently evil, I've created all this negative karma, just a disaster. Let's go smoke a joint. You know? I mean, this is the way our mind works. And if you can see how it's totally based on false conception, isn't it? Totally based on false conception. Because it's based on the idea that there's this big I with this big identity, and there's no such I existing. The I is simply a label given in dependence upon a combination of body and mind. Okay? So, you know, contemplating this is very good for us. Yeah? Especially like when your mind really gets into attachment or neediness. You know, we all have this kind of emotional neediness. I need... Lama Zobe, so great. He said, I'll come back to this point, but he said when he was teaching about patience and the benefits of practicing patience, how we can't practice patience with somebody kind to us. We can only practice patience with somebody who you know, is rotten to us. So he said when you really want to practice patience, then you need somebody who hates you. You need somebody who harms you. The bodhisattva needs somebody who's obnoxious, and the bodhisattva's so happy. Finally, there's somebody I get to practice patience with. And he said, we're always pining, I need somebody to love me. But what we actually need is to practice bodhisattva path is we need somebody to hate us. Yeah, we need somebody to be mean and rotten to us. Yeah? And if you think about it, it's true. Because it's totally impossible to practice patience with people who are nice and kind and considerate to us. Yeah? How are you going to practice patience with somebody who is so wonderful to you? You can't. And if you don't practice patience, there's no way to become a Buddha. So we need that obnoxious person. We need them more than we need the person who loves us. I want somebody to love me. Okay? So when that mind comes, who needs somebody to love? Who's that one that needs somebody to love them? Who is it? Find that person. That feeling is so vivid and so real, isn't it? You know, when we have that needy mind, I need somebody to love me, if only somebody would love me. I mean, this was my whole mantra for years, you know. I suspect that other people have been the same. You know, I need somebody to love me. And then you just put the question, who needs somebody to love? Who? Who's the one who wants to be loved? Who? Feels so real, doesn't it? It feels so real and so solid. Find that person. Search everywhere. Search throughout the entire universe, the external universe and the internal universe, and try and find that person who needs somebody to love her or love him. Yeah, you really try and find. And then you see, when we say, I need somebody to love me, you know, we only say I on the basis of a few thoughts, a few emotions that happen to be in the mind for a few minutes. Because that feeling of, I need somebody to love me, how long does that stay in your mind? I mean, our concentration is so bad that even if we try to develop single-pointed concentration on I need somebody to love me, we would get distracted. You know, it's like, how long can we sit there in the midst of our pity party going, I need somebody to love you? How long can we do it? I had a friend who was a hospice nurse, and you know, she's really seeing people in strong emotions, and she said no matter what strong emotion somebody has, they can't hold it for more than 45 minutes. Mm. You know? Fear, anger, whatever it is, because she's seen some really big situations. She said, you know, nobody can hold on to it. So on the basis of a few thoughts that are coming in the mind for a few moments, we say, I need somebody to love me. And that thought consumes the entire universe, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, when that thought's there, it really, there is nothing else in the universe but that needy I. Are you guys resonant? Do you know what I'm talking about? I hope I'm not the only one. Yes. Uh-oh.
No, because we can't concentrate.
But that I, you know, that needy I consumes the entire universe, doesn't it? There's nothing else existent at that point when we get into that needy I who needs to be loved. You know? Other people don't exist, the house doesn't exist, our food doesn't exist, our Dharma teacher doesn't exist. Anything else that we could possibly be important, let alone existed, ceases to exist because that I, you know, fills entire space. And who's, you know, it's just mind-boggling when we begin to see how out of touch with reality our mind is. Mm. You know, Lama Yeshe used to say to us, you don't need to take LSD, dear. You're hallucinating already. And you know, he's right. Mm-hmm. He's totally right. We're hallucinating all the time. Right? And when we begin to see how out of touch with reality our mind is, then we take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Okay? Because there's nothing else that's going to show us the way to reformat the hard disk than Buddha Dharma Sangha. I mean, this hard disk, the hard disk of our mind, needs radical reformation. Yeah. Delete everything. Reformat. Install a new operating system. You know. That's exactly what we're trying to do. Yeah. It's like the present operating system malfunctions. It's totally out of contact with reality. Yeah. And so why do we take refuge? What are we taking refuge in? Determination to be free, bodhicitta wisdom. Okay? What, you know, what's the wisdom? The wisdom that things are impermanent? The wisdom that contaminated things are not happiness? The wisdom that things lack a self? The wisdom that nirvana is peace? Okay? So we take refuge in that wisdom. That wisdom, that's the Dharma refuge. That's the Dharma refuge. Okay? Buddha's the one who described the Dharma refuge and whose mind is one with the Dharma refuge. Sangha, and these are the Arya Sangha, the ones that have realizations. They're the ones that have that wisdom. They haven't completely cleansed their mind, but they've realized that wisdom directly. Okay? So those are our true guides. And that's our true refuge. And if we take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, we're never going to be let down. Okay? Because that wisdom never gets stale. It never gets old. It's never outdated. You don't have to trade the wisdom realizing emptiness in for the latest update. Okay. Yeah. So the mind becomes completely satisfied with the wisdom realizing emptiness. And so when we really take refuge in the three jewels, we're never going to be alone. We're never going to be abandoned. We're never going to be, you know, confused, floating around with helplessly. Okay? And so you can see the more we understand the Dharma, then the deeper our refuge goes. The deeper our refuge, the deeper our commitment to the Dharma. Because what we're committing ourselves to is reality. Okay? We're committing ourselves to the conventional reality that sentient beings are valuable. That sentient beings are worthy of love. We're committing ourselves to the ultimate reality that things lack any permanent, solid, inherent existence. Okay? If we commit ourselves to that and to developing that, even we don't have it, we're committing ourselves to developing it, we can never go wrong in our life. We can never go wrong. And if we really commit in that way and spend our life developing, you know, that wisdom and the bodhicitta, then at the time of death, then dying becomes like a breeze. They say for the highly realized practitioners, dying is like going on a picnic. You know? Whereas, you know, the people with attachment, dying is hell. They're separating from everything. Everything. Everything that's propped up our ego, we are separated from. You know? Not only the people, not only our reputation, our whole self-image, and this body. Everything we've spent our whole entire life attached to is deserting us at the time of death. If we haven't taken refuge in the Dharma, in wisdom and bodhicitta, dying is hell. Yeah. But if we have that deep refuge, then at least we can die without regret, we can die without fear, we have realizations, then they say dying is like going on a picnic. Mm. And if you've ever seen people die like that, or heard of people who have died like that, you'll know that death doesn't have to be a major freakout. My ordination master, Kabjilin Rinpoche, stayed in the clear light for 13 days when he died. Yeah? He just sat up in meditation, stayed in the clear light for 13 days. Yeah. Another one of, second Rinpoche, you know? He told his attendant he didn't feel well. He went into the other room, laid down, and left his body, and his hands were like this, like Bhadradhara's position. Another one of my teachers, Sangha Rinpoche, was the anniversary of the Buddha's descent from the Gagas. And he similarly just told his attendant, you know, kind of prepare this and prepare that, went into his room, sat up in meditation, and died. Yeah, breeze, going on a picnic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. No sweat.
Do you know how they generally wish it up?
About Geshe-Thapte, I don't know all the details. I know that they were doing pujas, you know, when he died. And that's the value of having Dharma friends around. It's like they were doing the practice, the meditation practice of his principal deity, so that I'm sure he was following along with it, you know, as he was dying. Because it was so familiar to him in his mind. So, you know, it's all in our own hands. How we die is totally in our own hands. Okay. Then what practice would you recommend for sentient beings that have died due to abortion? Do you mean the aborted fetuses, the sentient beings who were aborted, or the people who performed the abortion?
The second one.
The people who performed the abortion.
El que hizo el aborto o el niño que murió por causa del aborto.
El que hizo el aborto.
La persona.
Well, maybe I'll talk about both. Okay. In terms of the baby who was aborted, then it's very good to do any kind of Dharma practice that you can and dedicate the merits for that sentient being. You know, whether you were the one who aborted them or not, then it's good to, you know, dedicate for their benefit. In the case of the person who did the abortion, whether it's the doctor or the mother, or the father, or, you know, whoever participated in the abortion. So remember, the negative karma is accumulated not only by the people who do it, but the people who consent with it, who favor it, who rejoice at it. Mm-hmm. Okay? So then some purification needs to be done, you know, because it's taking of life. So then you want to purify, you know, by the four opponent powers as you would with any kind of negative action. And I think it's important, too, like if you were directly involved with an abortion, to say, you know, do your purification and then say, okay, now I'm really going to follow the Dharma. And by virtue of my Dharma practice, when I meet this sentient being in a future life, may I be able to guide them on the Dharma path, you know, as a way of making up for having aborted them. Okay. So, you know, sometimes this topic gets sticky because, I mean, people ask me, am I pro-choice or am I pro-life? And I say I'm both. Okay, because I think the political climate, the way this whole thing has been politicized, that both sides are missing the point. Yeah. Because I think what's most important in the case of an unwanted pregnancy is compassion for the child, for the mother, for the father, for everybody. You know, and I think people need. I think that people need to be able to make a choice, but they need to make wise choices. You know, I don't think this is something that should be legislated, because it just incites more hatred and more violence to legislate it. Yeah. On the other hand, I think if life can be preserved, definitely. Yeah. My little sister was the product of an unwanted pregnancy. She's adopted. And her birth mother, you know, carried her, gave her up, and as a result, I have a little sister. I'm very grateful to her birth mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I always wanted a sister.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Anyway, I think compassion is really the thing that's called for in those kind of situations. Not judgment and people, you know, sticking their finger in somebody else's face. For no matter which side of the political debate you're on. You know, because what you see in the political debate is a lot of anger on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
What does anger do to benefit the world? Nothing. Nothing. Okay.